Welcome to episode 2 of season 10 of Movie Room Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 crime classic, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jay Cluett of the Deep Blue Sea the Deep Blue Sea Pod. Welcome back to the show, Jay.
Hello, Rob. Thrilled to be here, whether you know the name of my podcast or not.
Yes. I've only, been on your podcast a few times. We talk about it all the time.
Yeah. You always say the Deep Blue Sea podcast, and it's Deep Blue Sea the podcast, and I never correct you.
It's Deep Blue Sea the podcast. Okay, see?
Yeah. Because it doesn't matter, it's fine. I think you'll find it whichever one you Google.
That's true. Probably true.
There's not many podcasts out there dedicated to Deep Blue Sea, so I hope you don't find other ones.
That's true.
There is another one that's got a similar name that is about the ocean. And we have had people retweet and follow and that kind of thing because they're looking for that podcast. And we'll take those retweets and follows. We are grateful for them.
Why not? All right. So episode 2 begins with the continuation of the main credits and ends with Green entering the turnstile. So yesterday we started by discussing all the credits of the movie, and today's minute continues.
There's more today.
With the credits, that's right. Yeah. I gotta say that they, even before we get through all of the credits here, there are less credits at the beginning of this movie than there are in most 1970s movies. At this point in time, they were putting all of the credits at the very beginning. So.
Yeah. I think this was nearing the point where they stopped.
Well, no, they stopped because of Star Wars. It was George Lucas who stopped the whole thing. And again, we're still talking 3 years away. But and the end of this movie has more credits than you usually see in movies also. Because it doesn't just have the names of the people. You know?
But you'll talk about that in December. Mm-hmm. That's not for today.
So,
that's for...
You might be able to talk about that too with me.
Sure, maybe I will.
Maybe.
I can't remember what's in the last minute, but I'm sure there'll be some.
Neither can I. I know that the sneezing scene is, I think, 3 minutes before the end. So.
Yeah, I missed that.
Yes, you do miss that.
One of the best endings to any film ever.
Yes,
for sure. But there we are.
Yep. So the credits continue, and we get the credit of the editor, Gerald Greenberg, and the editors, Gerald Greenberg and Robert Q. Lovett. So,
something about that. I just love the name Robert Q. Lovett. It's got a real ring to it as a name. Just it sounds so made up.
Apparently, it's not.
I hope it's not.
according to what I saw on IMDb, it's not. I can't guarantee that it isn't, but it supposedly is a real name. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, Robert Quincy Lovett, goes by Robert Q. Lovett.
That's right. So great. We will start with Gerald Greenberg. So Gerald Greenberg was born in 1936, passed away in 2017 at the age of 81. He has 46 IMDb credits as an editor. His final movie that he edited was the Point Break remake in 2015. Just to show.
Bad one to go out on.
Yeah, but also he was 79 at the time, so that's just amazing. He had 3 Oscar nominations for Best Editor, and he won for the French Connection. And. He himself was the editor of 4 Oscar-nominated movies, the French Connection, 4 Best Picture nominated movies, The French Connection, Kramer vs. Kramer, Apocalypse Now, and Awakenings, because obviously any movie that he's nominated for as the editor is a Oscar-nominated movie.
Sure.
Yeah. Then we
makes sense.
That's right. Then we go to Robert Q. Lovett. You love it, don't you?
I do. It's, yeah.
He was born in 1926, passed away in 2022, at the age of 95.
95. Well done, sir.
Seriously. And he only has 24 editing credits on IMDb. The most recent one was in 2006, which is 16 years before he passed away. He has one Oscar nomination for the movie The Cotton Club in 1981. But other than that, I really couldn't find anything out about him. As you said, his name is Robert Quincy Lovett. That's about it.
Yeah, well, he did. He edited a bunch of Kojak and The Equalizer for TV
Yeah, and the
as
movie
well.
Blowout with Travolta.
Sure, Bronx Tale.
So
Yeah.
he has a few stuff that he's done over the years of his career. And then the credits continue. Again, it's just so amazing listening to the music as these credits are moving along. It's like in some ways you want the credits to continue because the music is so great.
Yeah, it's just real bombastic.
Yes.
It's yeah. I can't. I'm not good at describing music, as you can tell. This is great music. I like listening to it.
Well,
That's as much
I
as I
know
can
you
tell
do. I know
you.
from when we talked about this on Saving Private Ryan how much you hate musical scores. So, the fact that you
I
like
don't
this
hate
movie.
musical scores, Rob. I do
Really?
not hate
Sorry,
musical
sorry,
scores.
sorry.
I don't
You don't
notice
remember.
them.
You don't remember that.
I don't remember or notice them. It's the general thing. But here, all you have is no offense to the credits, all you have is the music to listen to, and so it really stands out with ah, bum bum bum.
That's right.
Like it's real, yeah. Gets you going, gets you in the mood for the film.
That's right.
Yeah.
Then we get the credit for Stephen F. Keston, who is one of the producers of the movie. He's an associate producer in this movie. He was born in 1935, passed away in 2001 at the age of 66. And again, he also only has 12 producing credits on IMDb. Nothing that really stands out here. Maybe Conan the Destroyer, he was the executive producer. In this movie, he was associate producer. So, then the credits continue, and we actually get to see that this is based on the novel by John Godey. Now, do you know anything about John Godey?
He wrote the novel for Taking a Pelham 123.
Okay.
That's it. That's all I got. Never heard that name before today.
Okay, well, it because it's not his real name. It's a pen name.
Oh,
Which,
nice. Oh, Stephen King. Sorry,
no.
no.
Nice try.
That's
I've never understood the whole idea of pen names. But with Stephen King, I can sort of understand it when he wanted to be Richard Bachman because he wanted to see if people really wanted to buy his books because they're Stephen King books or because they're actually good. And he was actually able to prove
Yeah.
that they were buying them not just because of his name. So that makes sense.
And the opposite happened with, I'm not going to say her name, the lady who wrote Harry Potter. She tried to do the same thing, and people didn't like the book that she kind of got bad reviews for writing them under a pen name, and it came out as like, oh, I wrote this, and then people are like, oh, it is good, I guess. But it just kind of proves that she's not great. She kind of lucked out at writing stuff for kids that appealed to kids, and she tried to write stuff for adults, and she's trash. So good.
Okay, well, again, I don't know if I would completely say that Harry Potter is solely for kids. Harry Potter, it can be enjoyed on multiple levels.
True. I enjoyed it with them when I was a child, but now I see they are flawed. But anyway.
The movies or the books?
Both.
Both. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, nothing's perfect. Not even
Oh, I agree. I
movies.
agree.
Poor books. So, John Goody's.
Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Okay. Do you like the novel? Do you
Love the novel.
more than the movie or less?
No, the film's better, but the book's great.
Okay. Because the book likes to kill characters that are somehow resurrected in the sequel to the book.
Sure does. It's because they wrote the second book. Malcolm Crichton wrote the second book after the film had come out, and he was told you need to bring back Ian Malcolm. He got better. Yeah.
What better? What's that from? What movie is it from?
Turn me into a newt. I got better.
That's right.
Yes. Life of Holy Grail.
That's right.
Monty Python
Holy
Holy Grail.
Grail.
Yeah. Turn me
Yeah,
into a newt.
that's right. So John Goody's real name is Morton Friedgood.
Okay.
He was born in
Pretty good.
1912 and passed away in 2006. So he lived to the age of 90. Was it 94? Something like that.
94.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, that's 90.
Maybe he, I, Did he write book? Well, did he write everything under John Goody, or Goody? I think I'm on his Wikipedia. I think he did. I think Morton Friedgood. It's kind of the opposite to Roald Q. Lovett. Not a good name. Not a doesn't instill like this is a great author wrote this. Morton Friedgood. No offense to the Morton Friedgoods of the world,
But John
but
Goody
I think John.
does.
I mean, I still wouldn't have taken that. I would have picked like that surname Godey. I don't know how to pronounce that at first reading. Goddy, Goody, Goody.
Right.
It's
Free
ambiguous.
good,
I would
you're
I.
going to pronounce.
Right, but I don't like pronouncing it. So I think he should have had another run at picking a pen name, personally.
Possibly. Okay, fair enough. And then we get the next credit of the screenplay is written by Peter Stone. So Peter Stone was born in 1930, passed away in 2003, the age of 73. He has 36 IMDb credits. He won an Oscar in 1964 for writing the script for Father Goose. Have you ever seen that?
No, Cary Grant, right?
Cary Grant, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I'm aware of it.
And he actually, I found this fascinating. He wrote a musical about the Titanic that was basically released on film 20 years after he died. It actually got me really curious.
Okay.
I'm very curious to see it.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to see. I think I've missed it now. Titanic was like a musical. Starring, it had Nicole Parker in it as Celine Dion, as like the kind of it's set on Titanic, but if Celine Dion was on Titanic as well, kind of narrating it.
Oh.
I love Nicole Parker, and I missed. I just saw like clips of it online, but I didn't see the whole thing. So I'm guessing this is not
No, probably not.
that.
Probably not. It I think it's is it called Titanic the Musical? I think it's called. Which is that
Titanic, a new musical. I'm
a
seeing a
new
poster for it.
musical? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. I mean, that was a
No, it's
poster.
called no, it's called Titanic the Musical. He
Sure.
wrote
Okay.
the novel that it was based on, and then wrote the play also. I don't know, it's, again, it's
Oh, no, he wrote.
one of the
Yeah.
things that just feels very it's very curious, I guess you can say it that way.
Sure.
So I'm
And it came out in 97, the same year as the film.
the play maybe, but again the version, or the movie version of it, or the film version of it, was done in 2023.
I see. So maybe that's a. I don't know. Okay.
He also wrote Charade, which we talked about yesterday.
Yes, briefly. We talked about how I hadn't seen it.
Know. I said we talked about it. Same thing
Yeah.
as that.
It came up, sure.
Yes, it was one of the
Yeah.
things that we discussed. And then the credits continue with the producers. So we get both Gabriel Katzka and Edgar Sherrick, who we mentioned yesterday also. So Gabriel Katzka was born in 1931, passed away in 1990 at the age of 59. He has 17 IMDb credits. So again, not doesn't have that much information about it, but it's what's really cool is he was a producer on Kelly's Heroes and A Bridge Too Far,
Nice.
which are movies that I love.
Sure.
This is very cool. So Edgar Sherrick. So he was born in 1924, passed away in 2002 at the age of 78. He has 81 IMDb credits. And he is actually credited with creating the idea of Wild World of Sports in 1957, which was eventually bought by ABC Studios. And he, as we talked about yesterday, with his production company, he was connected to ABC. So, he was able to ride the wave for quite a long time with this idea of his, which again, it's a, are you familiar with what the World of Sports was?
Not in the slightest.
So it was basically a TV show that gave highlights of sporting events through the course of over the week and stuff like that. Again, just like you, I'm not a sports fan, but I remember how popular that was in the 70s and 80s and stuff like that. So.
Sure. He was also a producer on at least five different Stepford productions. The original, the remake. And then three TV films, Revenge of the Stepford Wives, The Stepford Children, and in 1996, The Stepford Husbands.
I guess he's a Stepford.
He milked that franchise dry.
Yes. That he definitely did, but hey, if it worked, why not?
Did it
I'm
work?
assuming he got paid for it.
Yeah, I hope so.
So so for him it worked. Yeah, again, I look at it from the perspective of people are able to get a movie made. Okay, so even if people hate it, they still got paid for it.
Sure,
They might have
yeah.
spent a lot of time, they spent a lot of money and all that stuff and whatever, but they still did, all the people working on the movie still, putting a lot of time and effort into it.
And it's incredibly impressive to get anything made, and then once it's made, get it out and released into the world so people can see it.
That's right.
So,
And to get the
yeah,
same
huge, huge props
idea.
to anyone.
To get the same idea made five times in five different incarnations is pretty
Sure.
impressive too.
Yeah, I think it'd be more impressive to get five different ideas made and produced and released. But there we are.
I would agree. I would agree. And then we get the final credit before the movie actually will begin is the credit of the director. Joseph Star Sargent. Have you ever heard of him before?
Yes, I have. I've heard of him for the other classic film he directed that I've watched fairly
I'm
recently,
assuming
which is, of course,
that's
Jaws: The Revenge.
Revenge, exactly.
A film I do enjoy.
Yes, I figured that. Wait, which version of it do you enjoy?
I've only seen the version where Van Peebles survives at the end.
Oh,
That's the only one. That's what's on DVD. That's what I got.
can't you find it on YouTube or something that scene? I'm not
I
familiar.
haven't looked. I haven't sorted out. I'm fine with what I've got. It's fine.
Okay. So yes, so Joseph Sargent was born in 1925, passed away in 2014. He has an astounding number of directing credits. He's 92 IMDb credits as a director over his career.
A lot of TV stuff, though.
Yeah. Okay.
Lot, yeah.
Again, he's still putting in the time and effort to.
Oh, sure. I didn't mean to say that that was any lesser than like cinematic releases. But it's mainly TV films.
And he has a very famous quote about this movie. Someone asked
I
him.
made it.
Someone asked him, "What is the real way to stop a runaway train?" So he said, "Well, what Mr. Green does in the film, which when he sets up all the paraphernalia to defeat the Dead Man Switch, that's all Mickey Mouse. That's not the way you do it. And I still don't know to this day how you actually do it."
I mean, sure. Good,
So,
it's useful. Thank you for your input, Mr. Sergeant.
but I just like the fact that he called it, it's all Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, just kind of shrugs and walks away.
That's right.
I don't know. Is there one that's on the loose right now? I can't help you. I'm sorry.
No clue.
Ask somebody else. I'm a director.
And don't ask Mr. Green.
Yeah.
And then, the movie begins. We're a minute and 37 seconds into the movie, and we finally get to see something happening on the screen besides the credits. And
Yep.
we get a shot of the street of 59th Street and Lexington. And you can see on the right-hand side of the screen, we are in front of Bloomingdale's.
So I think this is at least the third film I've covered with you that opens in New York. With Die Hard with a Vengeance and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
That's right. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I was thinking back. I was saying to myself, "When Harry and Sally didn't begin
No,
in
it
New York."
starts in
That's right. That's right.
Chicago.
So Chicago.
Which is where Planes, Trains ends.
That's right.
Reverse
And
films.
right, The Great Escape doesn't start in New York, right?
It doesn't. It's close. But that's not, yeah.
And hey, according to Die Hard, Live Free or Die Hard. So, Die Hard 2 also takes place in Chicago. So there you
Sure.
go.
The very, very big Chicago.
Wow, you're right. This is the third movie that we were discussing that starts in New York, and they're all in different places in New York. And
Yeah, but they all kind of look the same.
they're all in Manhattan, though. Yeah, so not only do they start in New York, they start in Manhattan.
We go.
Makes sense.
I look forward to your next film, Muppets Take Manhattan.
No.
Todd
I know that both you
will
and
be your
I was
co-host.
gonna say, I know that both you and Todd would be very happy, but
Oh, Nick will be here as well every day.
yes, but no. Sorry to disappoint all of you, that will not be happening. But if Jay wants to do it, that's fine too.
I mean, Jay would love to, but it's time. I just don't have the time or the expertise. I'm not the right person to host a Muppets film podcast. I'll listen to one, but I won't host one.
Okay, that's fair. All right, so we get a shot of Bloomingdale's. So what do you know about Bloomingdale's?
It's where Rachel Green worked in Friends,
Okay.
and that's about it. They sell clothes.
Okay, in what
They sell
year?
like.
Okay, and
No, yeah.
in what year do you think this clothing store was founded?
Sometime before 1974. But I don't know
You're in the
the just like the Pelham 1, 2, 3. I don't know, 65.
1861.
So 1865 is what I meant. So good. I was only 4 years out.
Yes. So as of now, it is 164 years old.
What?
It was founded by the brothers Joseph Bloomingdale and Lyman Bloomingdale. And
Sure.
it has been in the same spot for that entire time, which is
Okay.
quite amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Since then it's been bought up by Macy's, but Macy's bought it in 1930. No, sorry. Macy's bought it in 1994.
94. Okay.
And the as of today, they have a total of 32 department stores in the U.S. and three franchises outside of the U.S. In one in Dubai, one in Kuwait, and I don't know where the third one is. There's just three franchise stores in Dubai and Kuwait, so maybe it's one and a half in each, something like that. So yeah, I mean it's just amazing that they. Sorry. No, you see, it wasn't even. I was wrong. It's not in the same spot. It was. It's it
Picked
started
up
up.
and moved it across the street.
It's no, it started in the Lower East Side, and
Okay.
it moved to Midtown Manhattan in 1872, and then in 1902, they moved to this particular place. So yeah, I mean, it's just again, it's just mind blowing that a store like this can be open for 165 years.
Sure,
I mean,
yeah.
that just wow. And they actually kept it in New York until 1976. 1976 was when they first started opening up branches outside of New York. So that's also pretty impressive, you know, that they kept it for 100 and something years in that same spot.
Yeah.
Or just in that location, with nothing else.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so we get to see a busy 1974, you know, street with a lot of taxis. We see someone get out of a taxi.
It's Martin Balsam.
It's Martin Balsam, that's right. He gets out of the I wasn't able to read the name of the taxi cab company. I tried, but you know, but you see that he's rushing. He knows that he's late. He's late for something. He's carrying a package, and he is looking at his watch. And then he walks to get it, to go down the into the subway. And there's a sign at the entrance of the subway that says New York City Transit System. Brighton, 4th Avenue Line, Lexington Avenue Line, up and downtown Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. And then it says something really interesting at the bottom. It says, agent on duty, 6 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Monday through Thursday, Saturdays, closed Sundays. That's all there. You know. So it makes me wonder how people, you know, get on the train at that point. You know, if there's no ticket agent there to buy a... you know, a token or whatever you need.
Well, maybe I don't know. I don't know how the subway worked back then. I've only ever known to like, yeah, I've never had to like buy a ticket to right. use a, exactly. an underground train. I have an Oyster card or a credit card.
Exactly.
Just tap it and you go.
That's right. Well, in 1974, they didn't have that. So yeah,
I did not.
I don't know the answer to that.
So yeah, after that time, you just jump the turnstile.
That's right. That's right. And then we see him, you know, come through a turnstile. So what do you know about turnstiles?
I mean, I don't know when they were invented, but I know their purpose is to only allow one person, or supposedly only allow one person through at a time through a ticket barrier. They only rotate in one direction. There's like a locking mechanism that stops them from going back on themselves.
Okay, do you know?
And from what I've seen in numerous films, they're easy to jump over. Although I've never tried myself.
Smart move. Especially if you're chasing a criminal or things like that. Yeah.
Sure.
Do you know any other names?
Being chased by someone.
That's right. Do you know any other names for a turnstile?
Ticket, gate, barrier thing. No, having listened to this podcast before, a style turner is probably something like just the same things reversed.
It's a gate line, a baffle gate, an automated gate, or a turn gate.
Baffle gate is interesting because I know a baffle as being something else in terms of a gate, like a kind of thing that I guess it's similar. Yeah, it's like slows the flow of like smoke or noise.
Okay.
Yeah, it kind of works for here right. as well, I guess.
The point of a turnstile is to allow, it's a gate to allow one person to pass at a time. You can have it configured to only work one direction, so that because there are mm-hmm. turnstiles that work both ways. There are places like here, which it's restricted that your person has to insert a coin, a ticket, transit pass, security credentials, or any other type of payment or verification. Obviously, today things are much different. The modern technology, allows for biometrics, retina scanning, fingerprints, all these other things that you see in movies that people can actually now do. Yeah,
sure.
It's similar to the idea of public transportation, how they have that you have to, you know, you have a barrier that you can get through in order after you pay, or a pay toilet, or different types of office buildings or lobbies and stuff like that. So the idea of the turnstiles goes really, really far back. because they used to use them on toll roads, but obviously things were done a little differently than what they are today, the way that we see them. But the modern idea of them, they started using them at in buildings and amusement parks in the 19th century, sports stadiums, things like that. And then they started using them that you can, you know, put in coins or tickets in order to help people you know, go a little faster. And that all pretty much started in the in the mid 60s. And you know, by now it's just by now in 1974, you know, it's a typical thing that people are you know, just gonna easily just put a token in and be able to get onto the train that they want to get onto and stuff like that. So yeah, that's just a little tidbit about turnstiles, which that would be interesting. So he makes it through the turnstile by holding up the package that he has, and then that's where the minute ends.
It stresses me out that he was like checking his watch earlier because like he's clearly late. This is a very important. He needs to be there on time.
That's right.
If he misses this train and he catches the next one, this is all over. This is like
Well,
it has to be this train.
I think that's part of the whole idea here with the you know we with his character throughout the movie. You know, we will see that.
Yeah,
You know, he's the most
I get
nervous out
he's
of
got a
everybody.
cold. Yeah, he says later he's got a cold. He woke up that morning, and so he's gonna have been like a bit on the drag all day, I guess.
Well, again, we do know approximately what time this is. This is sometime you know,
After 1:23.
it's sometime between 1:23 and probably maybe 10 to 2, something like that, depending on how long.
I was expecting you to have worked out what station this was and known like exactly what time it was going to be.
Well, okay. In all fairness, in the script, it actually tells us what time it is that he's looking at his watch, but
Okay.
it's hard to say whether it's accurate from that perspective. You know, because it
Okay.
just says that it's 1:52. You
Sure.
know,
Okay.
I don't know if that's really how long it would take or not. It could just be maybe they took it out of the movie because in the script it's supposed to be superimposed on the screen. But my assumption
Oh,
is
okay.
they took it off because they probably realized that okay, it doesn't matter.
That's just annoying. Yeah.
Right. We don't need to know how many minutes are
It's
left.
just a, another layer of continuity we have to keep up with.
That's right.
Let's get rid of this immediately.
Completely.
Yeah. This isn't high noon. Doesn't matter what time it is. Get out of here.
And it's also not you know, it's not being told in real time, so we don't have to worry
Yeah, it's
about
not
that
like Russian Ark or something. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about this particular minute?
No, I thought we were going to dig more into Martin Balsam, so I was like, "Hey, he's great. I love him. He's great in Psycho and Two Angry Men."
Okay.
But maybe that's tomorrow,
If you'd
actually.
like to talk about
That's all I had was like, "Hey, he's like a like good, dependable character actor. Like whenever he shows up in something, it's like, oh, good, Martin Balsam's here. This he's going to be playing like a fairly solid guy, which you know, amongst the hijackers, he's the most agreeable, I think.
Well, because he's not a
But
real criminal.
yeah, exactly. Well, he is a criminal.
No, but he's not a real hijacker. Let's put it that way.
Not a career criminal.
He's not
Yeah,
okay.
but
He's
yeah,
not
he's
someone who has experience with what they're doing here. How's that? Is that a better way
sure,
to
absolutely. Yeah. But he probably has played like real dicks in films in the past. I don't know. I've only ever seen him play nice guys. So.
look at it? Yeah. I mean, I remember he was in the Delta Force.
I didn't see that.
I thought you were a Chuck Norris fan. Guess not.
No, I've seen very few Chuck Norris films. I've seen the Expendables 2 and
They're good.
Dodgeball.
I
I don't think I've seen like a Chuck Norris film. Like Chuck Norris.
Understandable. Okay, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Blues Day Tuesday, where we will discuss the performances of Robert Shaw, who plays Mr. Blue.
Sure. I have five.
Ooh, I'm
I have
very impressed.
six technically, but I don't remember. Apparently he's in the Lavender Hill Mob. Don't remember him in that, so pass. So number five, I've only seen this because of my podcast. He is in The Deep, which he was clearly trying to cash in on something else that's going to be up on my list later on. The Deep's fine, it's a shark movie, it's fine. Number four, I got him as Doyle Lunnigan, I think, is in The Sting. He's excellent in The Sting. I thought the Sting is more of
I don't like him as a bad
a
guy. That's
Paul.
the thing. I
I do. I think he's good as a bad guy. But I don't think, when I think of the Sting, I think of Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I don't think of Robert Shaw. So that's why it's number four.
No, me
Number
neither. Well,
three.
sorry, when I say I don't like him as a bad guy, I mean I love him in this movie as a bad guy. But I meant I don't like him as like a bad businessman type of thing. That's
Okay. Well, he's a bad guy in at least three of my films, because at number three, I have him as Red Grant in From Russia with Love, which he's like a real quintessential Bond henchman. He's like one of the blueprints for how they would like use henchmen in films to come. And he's great. He's one of the best henchmen across the whole franchise, I think. Red Grant, like a real like equal to Bond. Just the scenes with him and like on a train again. He's like, yeah, him and Connery on the train are great. Number two, we have this film, Taking Up Pelham 1, 2, 3. For reasons that you'll discuss over the next 5 months. He's great. He's just real like solid presence. I forget this is Robert Shaw in this one. It's
It's
just,
the mustache.
I don't know, because
It's
yeah, he's got a disguise.
the big mustache.
I forget all kinds of things. I always forget who's the undercover cop in this. Every time I was like, who is it? Is it that guy? Is it the guy who says, what, you've never seen a sunset before? No, it's not. Yeah, you'll cover it. And the number one, a little film I like to call Jaws, in which he's just great. He's just, steals every scene he's in, throws a knot over his shoulder, doesn't even check it, is drunk all the time, both on set and off, on screen and off. I'm pretty sure I plugged this in your previous season of your show, but I'm going to do it again. If you get the chance to see The Shark Is Broken, the stage production written by and starring Ian Shaw, Robert Shaw's son, playing his dad, do it. It's well worth your time. It's like an hour and a half long. It's three guys playing Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, and Robert Shaw hanging out on the set of the Orca in between. Well, not the set, the floating set of the Orca in between. Takes waiting for the shark to work in Jaws, and it's excellent. And Ian Shaw plays Robert Shaw perfectly, and plays him as a real horrible person to be stuck on a boat with for days on end, trying to work with. But it makes me appreciate the film more. So yeah, number one is of course Jaws. It will be most people's number one
Probably.
this
It'll
season.
probably be very high up there.
It'll be, I'm going to call it now. It'll be in the last episode of this season. It'll be number one.
Okay.
It's going to be. I don't know what else it could be.
All right. And now we will do the daily game, Name That Remake. So
Okay.
we will spin the wheel.
Spin the wheel.
Okay. And we have a winner.
Okay.
All right, so the first movie here, the original movie, came out in 1969,
69. Okay.
and the remake came out in 2010.
Okay.
All right, and it is a about a it's a Western about a bounty
Okay.
hunter that is trying to track someone down.
I mean, I'm gonna say again, is it 310 to Yuma? No? Okay. That was a serious guess.
Okay. All
A
right. So
bounty hunter trying to.
let me explain that a little better. A young girl hires a bounty hunter to go help try and find the man who killed her father.
Oh, True Grit.
Yes. Very good.
True Grit. Of course, it's True Grit. I have seen the remake, but not the original. I
Okay. Yes. So it is True Grit from 1969 and
got one.
2010. Yes. right. So, Jay, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Jay Clovett?
Sure. Deep Blue Sea, the podcast for all of my shark-based podcasting, or lifeversusfilm.com is my personal blog, where I have actually been writing stuff this year. It's been my most
Yes.
prolific year of writing
I've
in
been
a
very happy
decade, maybe.
to see you writing all
Twin
about Twin
Peaks.
Peaks, which I don't know anything about.
Sure. It's a fun show. I'm enjoying it. It's going some places. David Duchovny showed up for a while as a character they expected to be called Dennis, but who now goes by Denise. And I was surprised that I had David Duchovny playing that role, and then I remembered, oh, it was 1991. Okay.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moveaboutminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moveaboutminute@moveaboutminute.net. So until tomorrow, chew.
Your zone tight.